We talk about Draymond Green's latest suspension and the possible end of the Warriors dynasty, Victor Wembanyama and the Spurs figuring some things out against the Los Angeles Lakers, and Giannis Antetokounmpo and the Pacers fighting over a game ball. That and so much more coming up right now on this episode of No Cap Room.
Hello, friends. Welcome to another edition of No Cap Room here on the Ball Don't Lie Podcast Network. My name is Jake Fisher, senior NBA reporter at Yahoo Sports. I'm coming to you from rainy San Antonio, Texas. Joining me as always, senior NBA writer for Yahoo Sports. It's my man, your man, everyone's man, Dan Devine. Staying warm in Brooklyn. What is up, buddy?
Jake, Yeah, you're right. I'm staying warm in Brooklyn. I'm not in Texas. I don't get the opportunity to have delicious breakfast tacos, but I do get the opportunity to spend a part of my morning with a lovely guest. And that guest is you, the host of this show, Jake Fisher. I just kind of briefly lapsed into doing Divine Intervention, and we're just going to go with it. The vibes are weird. The energy is odd. We got guys fighting over game balls. We've got people getting suspended indefinitely. I'm barely sleeping. You're traveling. Let's just fucking do it, man. Let's go for it.
Let's fucking do it. Put my head to the pillow last night at this lovely Fairfield Inn, and my ear just started throbbing. And my
That's what
eyes,
you're looking for.
Yeah. The sleep deprivation is real, but we are not on a losing streak here like the San Antonio Spurs or the Detroit Pistons. We're gonna discuss a bunch of stuff today. Definitely some game ball bullshit. Definitely some San Antonio takings and feelings and scene observing. But the first thing, and it's definitely one of the newsier things that I think will happen this entire NBA calendar, is the potential end of the Warriors dynasty by way of Draymond Green's indefinite suspension, which was announced last night, right before tip-off of my 7 p.m. local time Spurs-Lakers game, which was supposed to be LeBron's potential first clash with Victor Wembanyama on an NBA court. Alas, he went through a pregame warm-up. He was shooting left-handed three-pointers and having a great time with all the Spurs ball boys, but he did not play. They will be clashing Friday. I will not be here because I have yet another wedding, the 17th of my 2023.
Wow.
But it's the last one. Thank fucking God. They've all been lovely. But it's been something else. Anyway, right before tip-off, I was on the phone with someone from the union, and we were just chopping it up, saying hi, and then the news broke, and the word indefinitely was read aloud, and this person on the other line said, "I'm going to have to call you back." And that was my entry into the overall discourse about what is happening here. So to recap the newsy stuff before we get into all the layers of this, Draymond's suspension after twirling and whacking Yusuf Nurkic in the face, not quite long after choke-holding Rudy Gobert to be suspended 5 games. He is suspended indefinitely. He has no timetable by explanation from the league because they want him to have the opportunity to seek help and counseling that he needs. And there will be a meeting taking place between Warriors GM Mike Dunleavy, Draymond Green's representative Rich Paul, to kind of figure out pathway back. And then the league is going to give him criteria, not the same, but a la Kyrie Irving coming back from his anti-Semitic, whatever that whole thing. Remember that a year ago?
It's been a year.
Glad there wasn't a new chapter of a certain geopolitical conflict while that was going on. And then Ja Morant's situation in Memphis, again, entirely different dynamic, but those are the only examples and precedents of criteria that I believe under Adam Silver's reign to get back onto the court. So We're going to keep going on this, but I've just been talking a lot. Dan, what was your first reaction upon hearing this, like, nebulous seeming? This has been kind of phrased and positioned as like the benchmark inflection point of Draymond's antics here.
Yeah, it, the thing that struck me first was open-endedness like this can mean, it can mean, I mean, it can mean anything, which is the point of leaving it open-ended. But in the past, you know, there was an, I believe the team had said that Draymond was going to take like an indefinite leave of absence after he punched Jordan Poole in the face. And then that only wound up being, you know, a couple of games, and he was back for ring night, I think. Right. And it was like preseason suspension that then he came back for the start of the regular season. And so somebody had, when I was discussing this last night, somebody said, well, listen, indefinite could just mean he comes back in two games. And that doesn't feel like what's going to happen here.
I would be shocked
if that was the case. But I also think that the indefinite suspension, and you're right, the other sort of precedential examples here would be Kyrie with the Nets and Ja with the Grizzlies before the second incident with Ja that led to the firm full 25-game suspension. Just broadly speaking, as far as what, you know, what, how it, issues are adjudicated at the league level with players and how discipline is meted out, I think that's going to be an interesting, maybe something to keep an eye on, maybe something to monitor, like the because there's a glass half full way to look at an indefinite suspension, and there's a glass half empty way to look at it. And the glass half full one is this allows the league some, you know, leeway and flexibility in dealing with like case by case matters that could involve mental health issues or sensitivity training or sort of touchier subjects that are not simply this is a, you know, a physical act that is being responded to with a set level of punishment. And so there's a way to look at it that is this affords greater flexibility for the league to be more sort of considerate and conscientious in the way that it interacts with players and trying to find a resolution to situations that is maybe more mutually beneficial than just, you know, hammer hitting nail. The pessimistic view is it's a pretty big power grab to just sort of say, you're suspended until we think you're sorry enough, or yeah, we feel confident that you've sufficiently, you know, met whatever amorphous criteria that may or may not even like be firmly laid out by the league. And if you were someone who looked skeptically at institutions and power structures, you might be like, well, the guy who works for the owners being able to say, you don't get to play until I say so, maybe isn't the most awesome thing for like labor relations. And so whether that, I mean, that's a bigger picture thing worth keeping an eye on. The specifics of Draymond, I mean, I don't know. We came on here a few weeks ago and you kind of like made fun of me a little bit for psychoanalyzing where Draymond was at. And then,
so yeah, take a victory lap about being right about someone's curious mental health situation.
All right. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying what looked to me at the time of the Gobert incident, like this is maybe somebody who is trying to process something big and in a way that's not working quite right, and doing it in a way where like what is required of him to meet the, get to the competitive level that he needs to get to have the kind of impact to which he's accustomed, like is, it's maybe bleeding over the edge now. And whether, you know, this certainly doesn't make me think that less. I'll say that. And so, I mean, just in terms of what it means for Draymond Green, what it means for the Warriors, is there's a ton to figure out there. But just like, it feels like an inflection point. You know, the Warriors are 7-8 when Draymond actually plays. He hasn't played all that much. They've been outscored by 10 points per 100 possessions with Draymond on the floor. That is not the way things have typically gone. The Warriors have been outscored this season with Steph Curry on the court. That is not the way it goes for the Warriors. And, you know, we're at this place where what has worked for them and what has been the bedrock of this institution for more than a decade now feels like it's crumbling out from underneath everybody's feet, and it's going to require tough decisions. It's going to require some, maybe some painful realizations and maneuvers. And this is maybe the latest installment of that for a pretty proud franchise and a bunch of pretty proud players.
For sure. I mean, we're recording this Thursday, December 14th in the morning. I'm going to be whipping up my December 15th trade deadline primer notebook thing for tomorrow. This situation is just one of many elements of what's going on in the Bay that is going to have the Warriors. I mean, last year it was all about, all right, they're not exceeding expectations. They're not even meeting expectations. What's going to happen with James Wiseman? That was kind of where things were. They turn them into Gary Payton. This situation now is like far more, who the hell knows? They could go so many different directions. I just want to keep it to Draymond for a second, and then we're going to touch on the other pieces, because from a like overall Warriors dynasty state of Golden State with Steph Curry standpoint, that's the biggest thing here. Like Draymond's absence, continued absence in and out of the lineup. I mean, he's been ejected from three games, already suspended from five. He missed two games to injury, one for personal reasons. He's been a part-time player. The thing that is so crazy is that before the indefinite thing came out, you know, I got a tip that like, oh, this could be upwards of 20 games when I woke up this morning here. I had no idea the validity of it. Then I got an email from one of those betting odds sites where they send, which I don't want to live in a world where there are gambling odds about what Draymond's suspension is going to be.
We do live in that world, man. It kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks. However, it was a data point that was presented to me in my never-ending quest to collect data points and then try to draw a straight line between them. The most likely odds, and usually these things are tied to some type of inside information. That's how these things work. It was plus 100 to be 21 to 30 games. It was plus 150 to be 11 to 20 games. And then it was plus 500 to be 1 to 10. So the odds were so, so, so in favor of this being at least a 10-game suspension. So just to kind of give, I mean, that's where I'm operating from, that like December 14th, the Warriors are already 11th in the NBA or in the Western Conference. We're about 20 games across the board for every single team in the league right now. So let's just work under the assumption it's going to be 10 plus. That's going to be already more than half the season that he's missed, which while teams are talking about validating their roster and we need more time, we need bigger sample size to figure out what we got to do, he's just going to not be a part of that very critical juncture here. That's a big issue. The one win for Golden State out of all this, which is a little too cap nerdy, but it is real. Someone texted me this morning. A lot of Golden State's decision-making is with one goalpost in mind of the massive, massive luxury tax bill that they have been paying, will be paying, was potentially the biggest motivation behind flipping Chris Paul, flipping Jordan Poole, and the 4 years, 120 remaining on his deal for Chris Paul's potentially expiring contract this year. They're going to save roughly $520,000 per game in luxury tax from what this one cap person texted me, which could be like pretty significant from a general accounting salary book standpoint, because you've got Klay Thompson making $43 million a year. He definitely wants an extension and is having the worst season of his career. I saw yesterday that Shams Charania put out the two-year $48 million number he was offered. I was a bit bummed that came out. I was trying to save that for the Friday notebook. That was the number I had heard and confirmed as well. I'd heard 250, but 48 seems like a particularly specific number. So let's say 248, which like, that was the number Draymond Green basically got. He got 4,100 last summer. And I do believe it was a matter of years and not money. I think if Golden State offered the same exact 4,100 that Draymond got, which they've been riding in lockstep with this big three, those two, what's your rocket analogy when the things get shot off the sides?
Oh, yeah, it's like the booster rockets that, you know, are there. They're there to get you into space, and then they fall away as it goes into orbit.
The booster rockets to Steph should have, you know, if they each got an equal 4 year $100 offer, I think Clay would have been signed, sealed, delivered, and fine. That's my reading of the tea leaves from what I've learned. He's still having the worst season of his career. Andrew Wiggins having the worst season of his career. There's not a lot of levers for this team to pull in terms of trade stuff to make things better, aside from really looking at what Andrew Wiggins and Jonathan Kuminga by tandem can go get them. I don't know if that's enough for a Pascal Siakam. I don't know if that's enough for anyone that's really going to be making this team that much better to then part with the number 7 pick that you made the whole Andrew Wiggins trade to get and then tried to trade it and then couldn't. And you came away with Wiseman and him. Like, the one silver lining of the young dudes is Moses Moody is a real player now. Started to see that around this time last year when I was in Sacramento for a week and the Warriors came into town and he like wasn't getting any opportunity. It was like but he was starting to show flashes and whatever. So it's one of the more interesting situations in the NBA, regardless of the Draymond thing, because they have Steph doing Steph things, but the point differential, to your point, is scary. And this is the first time I've really ever heard Warriors folks kind of talk so openly about, like, wait, we got to do something here. Like, there's plenty of teams who have been the this is fine house on fire meme, and the Warriors have always had a fire extinguisher to just put it out, because that fire extinguisher is a flamethrower named Steph Curry.
I like that you had those sort of the mixed metaphors about the fire extinguisher and the flamethrower there. What I've been thinking about with Draymond Green is the Warriors people seem to always talk about him being, you know, the fire of the team, that's a heartbeat, that soul. Yeah. It's like, this is kind of what it looks like when that burns you up from the inside out. And maybe when it starts to burn out. I mean, what you're talking about, trying to find, like, there's not easy answers for how to improve the situation as it currently exists. And that's, of course, I mean, like, what you had was the best starting lineup in the NBA for 2 years running, and then 4/5 of that starting lineup is now actively bad. Klay Thompson is trying
to... My sweet Kevon Looney, what happened?
I mean, if Kevon Looney turns it around, then wonderful. But it also wouldn't be particularly surprising for a guy who's essentially like the giving tree, who would just is like, okay, just, you know, take the bark, take the, you know, make a boat out of this, make a house out of it, whatever. I'll just kind of keep standing here and doing offensive rebounds and defending whoever you need me to until like I'm ground into dust. It wouldn't shock me if Kevon Looney's effectiveness dipped at a pretty rapid rate.
From a father of young children.
The Giving Tree is a very sad book, Shel Silverstein, but it's also lovely. It's what yes, of course, you devote these things to your children. I think I've also used that for like Stephen. Maybe I just like considering big men who don't score as giving trees.
They're just tall trees.
Something for me to think about. Yeah, I got to turn that one over in my head. But like Clay, you can see Clay just like he's trying to just sort of manufacture it. It's like, if I can just get a couple to go, I can get on fire. There's a stat that I like to look at sometimes about like touch time, you know, the essentially catch and shoot shots, but like the kind of things where we talk so much about Clay, like never dribbles. He never needs to, the ball, it's out of his hands before it even gets there. If that's on the shots that are between 0 and 2 seconds of touch time, but always been like 40, 41, 42, 45% on those throughout his career. It's 35.2% on those threes this season. Like the shots that have made him, he does not have right now. And it feels like he's chasing it and he's trying to like manufacture that hot hand and it's just not there. And if that's the case, and you are also at a place where he's no longer that, you know, elite two guard point of attack defender that he was, or at least not able to muster that consistently, then and he never gets to the line. He converts well at the rim, but he never shoots at the rim. And it's a lot of like one dribble mid-range pull-ups or catch and shoots that are going all over the place because he just doesn't have it. That's a damaging player, you know? And Draymond has, you know, shot it better this year when he's been on the court, but obviously is damaging in a lot of other ways. And the defense that is normally elite when he's on the court has been worse when he's on the court this season. Wiggins, the championship version of that player, was a, you know, defended everybody's number one option and was a aggressive rebounder, helped you on the offensive glass, helped you in transition, made quick decisions with the ball. It was another like sort of driver once the defense was already bent by Steph, and he's just not doing any of that right now. So like you can only solve so many problems at once when 4/5 of your starting lineup is the problem. So in terms of where the help would be coming from outside the house, like unless they can convince somebody to take like, unless they're able to turn like Chris Paul's big expiring and whatever draft assets they've got that's not nailed down into something else immediate. And I don't know what that would be. And that would also be, you know, robbing from what is working, which is that second unit to fix other problems. it's the, you know, it feels like the cavalry's not coming. And if there's going to be any salvation, it's got to come from within. We've said for a long time, and a lot of people have said for a long time, sort of through Steph Curry, everything is possible. It's like, this is an awfully tall order, even for someone as, you know, all time great as Steph.
Yeah. The Chris Paul expiring contract trade chip, if you will, to your point, is a good point to raise. I just don't see, we can talk about this more next week for sure, when like trade season's fully open.
Sure.
I don't see a ton of teams right now who want to give up a good player for expiring money. There's like 24 teams. It's basically everyone outside of, this will be a good transition into my scenes from San Antonio. It'll be everyone outside of Detroit, San Antonio, Charlotte, Washington. That's kind of it. Like even Utah, they're an interesting one to save for another day. There aren't like a ton of sellers right now. With the play-in tournament's biggest impact on the NBA has been that.
Absolutely.
That every single team pretty much thinks they're still in it until February, and then they start to panic. Oh my God, we're not. But that's besides the point. The Spurs are in the middle of their longest losing streak in franchise history. It dropped to 18 games last night. They were feisty in the comeback. They were down 20 in the fourth. And then Victor Wembanyama did Victor Wembanyama things. Some other threes were hit. He had this ridiculous step back sidestep where it's like, man, if you think James Harden can create separation, wait till you put a 7'4" man doing it. They still lost 122-119. LeBron didn't play, as I mentioned, which was disappointing because that's really the reason I was here. But that's okay. We made lemons out of lemonade. Wemby can do it all. Like, it's been a month since I saw him in Madison Square Garden. And last night, 30 points, 13 rebounds, 2 assists, 6 blocks. The blocks were, some of them were breathtaking. There's one sequence I saw you quote tweeted when I checked the interwebs this morning where he had a vicious one hand, like half spin dunk over Anthony Davis, ran down the floor, either blocked or deterred a floater from Max Christie to the point where it was very easy for the Spurs to turn around and break into transition. And yet Wembanyama, who was at the point of the shot, beat everyone down the floor with his long galloping strides and caught a ridiculous alley-oop. And it was like awesome to watch. It was more awesome to hear him say post-game how, like, none of these stats matter. I need to pull up his direct quote, but it's been impressive how he has handled himself continually in the midst of all this losing, because I hadn't seen them when they were losing 18 straight games. What he said, if I can find the quote, he said, "I'm trying to do everything I can for the team. I've been trying to focus on rebounding a lot more and just being a more solid player for the team, never being soft. But it's still a work in progress, you know, and to me, it has no value so far." That's him saying his stats, his, you know, record breaking, whatever, you know, youngest player to do this, doesn't matter until they win games, which is the right mindset. It could sound so simple and easy of a lift, but when you really think about it, this entire state of Texas has been treating this man like the savior, let alone just in San Antonio. And he's been being handled with kid gloves and all that whatnot. And like, he's still kind of holding the right disposition. That's the thing that everyone I've talked to in and around the Spurs continues to harp on. Like, the guy apparently sleeps 10 hours a night. Like, he has no social life. He goes to the gym. He goes to the gym. He eats the most perfectly tailored diet for his body. He stretches forever and sleeps 10 hours, to the point where when he had that nasty ankle turn against the Rockets and this like came back like nothing had happened, Zach Collins told reporters at Shootaround on Wednesday morning that Victor said he didn't even feel it. So, jeez. It's I'm
trying to think of something that could be more diametrically opposite for me. It's like he sleeps 10 hours a night. He eats the perfect perfect diet for his body type. He's constantly stretching. He doesn't feel any pain when something happens. He's not creaking and just like, oh, whoops, I guess my ankle sucks now. He and I are living very different experiences. I'm also more than twice his age, so maybe that factors into it somewhat. And I'm a foot and a half taller. Yeah, shorter than he is. So, you know, that plays into it too. But
yeah.
I mean, the fact of everyone, I think we got ahead of ourselves when we saw him right away and we're thinking like, listen, maybe they're good. I know I came on this show and I believe the phrase I used was, I want to get drunk on Victor Wembanyama. I did say that. And I hold to that comment. I feel good about it, but it doesn't mean that this was always going to be a bad team. It was a question of degree. And are they close? You know, you mentioned the play-in tournament earlier. Like, would they be respectable Correct. Enough to stay in that mix? And the answer to that is no. And has very clearly the answer is no. But then it's about, it's heartening that his mindset is, what can I do to make us functional and better and improve the team? And I think it's probably, broadly speaking, heartening that the franchise's approach is, what can we do big picture to do that around him? Because everybody knows, and I wrote about it, and we've talked about it, and it's been a talking point all season, the only lineup construction that really works for San Antonio is you put Victor Wembanyama on the court with Trey Jones, and that's kind of it. You give him a point guard to serve him and serve other people, and then the offense works.
Hey, Dan, can I tell you a secret?
Yeah.
They're still not doing that.
I know.
Yeah.
I wrote the whole big friggin' point Sohan thing, and then they did 20 games of that, and then 20, and then it goes away. And then you're like, all right, well, of course. Now you've decided that doesn't work because no one can score, and so you're going to put the point guard on the floor. And the answer to that has not been the case. What was the lineup that you saw? What have they been starting with? What did you see when you went to the game last night?
So it was a good, even though LeBron didn't play, it was a good time to like check back in with the Victor Wembanyama Spurs, because this was game three of them not just abandoning point Sohan, but abandoning the two big lineup with Zach Collins, because Zach Collins apparently forgot how to shoot threes. He went through a rigorous three-point shooting workout at the end of shoot around. Like, truly every single Spurs player had left the floor but him. And he's working out with Gorgui Jang and Greg Steensma and Matty Nielsen on the coaching staff. Three coaches to one guy, just ripping shots on that perimeter. This guy's dripping sweat. And then PR graciously, from my standpoint, convinced him to then immediately sit down at a podium and talk to us. And I was just like watching the beads of sweat narrowly minnow away from his eyes. I felt bad for him, but I was grateful that he got to talk to us, because that was one of the things I wanted to ask. The starting lineup now, Sohan is still there while Collins is out. Malachi Branham is in. So five of the Spurs' last five first-round picks are all out there with... So it's Victor, Sohan, Malachi, and then Devin Vassell and Keldon Johnson, where anyone in that lineup is allowed to take the ball up off a make, off a miss, off an inbounds, whatever. And they kind of just figure it out. It still feels like... I would be curious to actually look at the numbers. Anecdotally, last night, it still felt like Sohan had the ball as it crossed the timeline more than anybody else. And then like they would bring in Trey Jones every now and then. They did a whole hockey lineup switch in the first quarter to take those five guys out. And then the lineup with Zach Collins, Chetty Osman, Trey. I'm gonna see if I can keep remembering the guys. I'm running out of brain power. It's too early. One thing, like, they never played Devontae Graham. Maybe that'd be... Maybe that would help some things.
He was a point guard who could shoot once upon a time. The guy can run a pick and roll, you know?
Like, maybe that would help. He was definitely not good in New Orleans, which is partially why they paid a first-round pick to get off of his contract. But, like, he's still an NBA player. He's still a veteran. I don't know. I did have that thought as I looked down the bench to be like, why is this guy not even touch the court? Right. The defense is encouraging. They were the worst defensive team in the history of the NBA last year. Over their last 10 games, they are 12th in the league in defensive rating, and seems a large part due to Victor.
Sure.
I don't see... Sohan is definitely like a long rangey guy to throw at opposing guards. But just to see the gravity that Victor, like you talk about Steph's gravity on offense, the gravity that he pushes back on opposing, whatever the scientific terminology would be. He's just altering shots and dissuading anyone from coming into the, he had 6 blocks last night, like we said.
Yeah.
And he definitely affected more. And it's there, like you saw it in the fourth quarter. I just, to go back to the Devontae Graham part, I am getting a little concerned that this stuff is like a little bit too aimless. Like they're just trying experiments just to see. They're like, oh, I'm just going to go to the ice cream shop and try every flavor for an hour and like bother everyone in line behind me before I make a choice. That type of thing. It's early. It's very early. Just having been up close and personal with the Sixers process years, and I asked Pop post game if any of Brett Brown's experience, who is now back as a Spurs assistant, could benefit them. He just said, in very typical surly Pop fashion, no, that's a different situation, which, come on, bro. That is an asinine, like, there's no necessarily causation correlation there, but like, the dude coached the longest losing streak in NBA history and then turned that team around into a perennial playoff threat with the MVP of the league. I think that's what you're kind of hoping to do here. So
no parallels whatsoever.
Yeah.
I think, well, not to preframe everything in terms of glass half full, glass half empty, but at least there, you mentioned them getting the 5 first round picks on the court. At least they're not doing what like the Pistons are doing, where they're just saying, yes, we'll keep rolling, you know, Isaiah Stewart and Bogdan Bogdanovic out there or Bogdan Bogdanovic rather, excuse me for mistaking my Bogdanoviches. And like, we're not going
to
play.
By the way, I'm too big a fan of Bogey to ever think he's Bogdan.
And we're not going to play like Cade, Ivy, Asar, and Durin together barely at all. Like, you know, whatever. They're not doing that. They're actually getting the guys on the floor to see what the minutes look like together. You're absolutely right to point to the defensive point of it. Like that was when I wrote about the Sohan experiment, that was sort of the revelation, to whatever extent it's a revelation, that I had, which is like, they clearly understand that having a pick and roll running point guard who can set the table is good and helpful. They're looking beyond that and saying like, we think that the league is moving away from small guards that can be exploited on defense. So let's figure out to the best of our ability how we can build a top 10 level defense and get enough playmaking on the floor around this guy. And it's going to take some lumps and some growing pains, but let's see how we can do it. So in that realm, moving from, or not putting Trey Jones back into the starting lineup, putting Malachi Branham in there and saying, all right, you, Keldon Johnson, Devin Vassell, you guys all figure it out. And you know, we'll, and our way to make this work is Victor's going to play more 5 because that's his end point anyway. And we're going to see if we can figure it all out. The number to watch for me there is when they've had Wembanyama, Devin Vassell, and Sohan on the court, they're giving up 109.8 points per 100 possessions. That will be a top 5 defense all season long. So if those are your like fundamental core guys that you're building around, you've already got what might be the heart of a pretty good defense. And now it's about whatever else goes around it. But you're right. Like, whatever else goes around it is offense. Whatever else goes around it is how guys score. And you are going to need to do that to win games.
Especially in the modern NBA when teams are putting up $150 every single night.
Yeah. I mean, like the longest view in the room, to go back to, you know, your man Sam Hinkie, like it is hard to maintain that amid pain. We'll see how effectively the Spurs do it. Like, no one has more job security than Greg Popovich. Nobody has more experience doing this than Brett Brown. And nobody has a longer runway than the team that just drafted the most transformational prospect of the last 20 years. So it should, in theory, be plenty of room for them to all figure it out. But, you know, 18 game losing streaks that turn into 20 game losing streaks that turn into 25 game losing streaks have a way of shaking that foundation a little bit. We'll see.
One silly positive note before we get out of San Antonio. They announced them as the world premieres of Victor Wembanyama's first 2 HEB commercials, which if you're an NBA fan listening to this and you don't know what an HEB commercial is, then you need to YouTube San Antonio Spurs HEB commercial right now. Victor Wembanyama has seen them. He told reporters postgame that he has watched the deep histories of this storied Texas grocery chain with the storied franchise. And the commercials have always like been very good at pulling on threads of these guys' personalities and play types and whatnot. Plenty of delightful spots between Manu and Tony Parker and Tim Duncan and Kawhi, and go down the list over the years. So the two that they debuted last night was one, Sohan does everything with one hand, which if you don't really get that reference,
watch him shoot Brown free again.
He is shooting free throws with one hand at the urging direction of Brett Brown, who did that with Nerlens Noel way back when. So
which basically turned Nerlens Noel into Steve Nash. So it all, you know, it all worked out.
Yeah. The other one was Victor walking into an apartment, which was clearly not his apartment, with his arms stretched out like a T. And this man had at least six red plastic shopping bags draped over each arm. And it was like team one trip. So if you, like me, have a sibling who still acts like you're in high school when you're home for your parents over Thanksgiving and they demand you come help bring in the groceries from a trip to the grocery store and there's only one bag left and you realize that you were only asked for like the principal of it all, get yourself a Victor Wembanyama to eradicate that issue.
Jake, you can't complain about being asked to help with the grocery bags. Let me ask you this. Are you cooking?
No.
I'm
bringing good hangs. No,
you're bringing good hangs. Good hangs are wonderful, but also if you're not cooking, if you're not cleaning, pick up the goddamn grocery bags.
I'm a cleaner.
But, yeah. All right, fair enough. I apologize for besmirching your cleaning reputation. The HEB commercials are delightful. The Spurs are less so, but they will. I have high hopes for the future. I don't have high hopes for the future of game ball etiquette based on what else we saw last night.
Yeah, I'm walking out of Frostbank Center, and I'll admit, I felt like a moron. I couldn't figure out how to get out of there. There's just too many layers, and it was too late. Like, I'd never seen an arena empty out so quickly. Like, it would have been an hour, but like, there was no, like, from the concession stands to like, it was a ghost town. There was one back hallway that like had weird fluorescent lights. I felt like I was in like the Twilight Zone. It was bizarre. There's one TV with ESPN on, and there's on the ticker, it says Giannis, you know, mad about game ball. And I hadn't really seen what had happened because I was in the post game. There was definitely a big contingent of the local San Antonio press were like following along about Giannis's career high number because they had to come back in because the Pacers trimmed the lead down to 10 and whatever. Then I get into the Uber and I start scrolling, which I try to do as little as possible these days. Because, and we're gonna go through the whole sequence here, but I'm probably making this into a bigger thing than it needs to be. I'm so saddened and disappointed by the what I'm calling the both sidesing of our society. It has been.
This is a really heavy entry point for that. I'm interested to see how this ties back to that problem.
Because. Okay. Now you have to be on one side or the other on anything, and you have to hate the other side and think they're wrong. And in this case, the Pacers, you have to be on the Pacers side or you have to be on the Bucks side. In our rundown, at one point I saw something was, who deserves the game ball? No one deserves anything in this life. There is no rule book and barometer and check mark to say, oh, you deserve this. It's just... we got to wake up and do our best and treat other people well. And that's really it. So the fact that this world we live in now, thanks to social media particularly, is driving a wedge between us on everything, including what celebration is bigger. Oscar Tshiebwe's first career NBA point or Giannis Antetokounmpo's career high. I got to pick a side. I don't want to pick a side. This whole thing is ridiculous. It is absolutely ridiculous. What occurred apparently So, like, the best way to unravel these events to show how ridiculous they were, the game ends and Giannis comes back out of the tunnel because he has been told that the Pacers took the game ball for his 64-point career high, which also set the franchise record in Milwaukee. The game was in Milwaukee. Apparently, it's this like huge affront that a visiting team could take a ball from an opposing arena when it's not like there's literally thousands of these Spalding balls in NBA facilities across the map. We've got $4 billion franchises. One ball, I think, could be pretty replaceable. So, do you want to stop me here? Do you want to stop me here?
I get, like, it does, I can understand it mattering that the ball you have to bring home with you is the one you actually scored 64 points with, or the one that actually was the one that went through the basket for your first point of your NBA career. Setting aside the part that we can get to about Oscar Tshiebwe's actual point count in his career, yes. I get that it's like, instead of somebody saying, like, congratulations, you've won a gold medal. Now, this isn't actually a gold medal. It's like, but it looks exactly like the gold medal.
That's what I'm saying. This isn't a gold medal. It's, Giannis might score 72 in 2 weeks from now.
Well, then he should get that ball too. That's a lot of points.
There is no should. There is no should. Look,
the part of this that matters most is that part of this that matters most is that everybody, you want to talk about everybody being wrong. Bucks security got the ball. It wasn't even the Pacers coaches who took it away. It was a Bucks security guard who went and got the ball. So the Bucks had the ball.
You're skipping too far ahead to really lay out.
I'm sorry. I'm getting very agitated.
Yeah, I am too.
Look, I'm trying to meet your level of agitation.
So the game ends. Giannis runs back out because he's learned that the Pacers took the ball. He is confronting Lloyd Pierce and Tyrese Halliburton and sticking his finger in Halliburton's nose, which, quick pause, I will say, this is kind of what the in-season tournament was really, really hoping to be about. It wasn't to be enough of a revenue drawer so you'll get Apple or Amazon to pay X number of hundreds of millions of dollars to carry like a couple of games, which that's another whole other thing. The goal was to also add rivalries and greater, you know, history between teams. The Pacers and Bucks clearly got something going on right now, and they play another home and home style game matchup in early January. So we got 2 weeks from that. That'll be get your programs calendared. Your calendars programmed.
Get your calendars programmed.
So the Pacers put out a tweet in the middle of all this to say, Oscar Tshiebwe moved to the United States and the Democratic Republic of Congo as a teenager to pursue his basketball dreams. Tonight, he realized his dream of playing in the NBA and scored his first career point. And that's who they got the ball from. That was the last editorialization of my part. Now, Big Oscar was like one of the most interesting stories in professional sports. Not really professional sports, but kind of if you look at it through the NIL lens back at Kentucky, because he stayed in Kentucky an extra year, partially because NIL weird NCAA rules wouldn't let him make money that he was deservedly, you know, deserved. He was able to because everyone else could if they didn't, well, they weren't here on a visa to play college basketball. That was a whole thing. It went to the courts. I remember being on the phone, it was back when I was at Bleacher Report. Like, they were fighting for his ability to make money, just like the guy at the locker next to him. And he stayed in college another year because he made like $2 million in NIL money. Like, his plight of battling with to get his and get his mark has been like documented and long. So the craziest thing about all this, to your point, is that back to the NCAA tournament, his first point did come in the championship game, but it didn't count. Because the 83rd game, the championship game, the scats don't matter. Anthony Davis's 40-point, 20-rebound game, throw it out. Didn't happen.
It's like it happened on Snapchat. Just erases after 24 hours.
That's a very good joke for a 40-year-old man. Look. Look. This whole thing is so dumb. You have Tyrese Halliburton tweeting out the cap on this app, which is hilarious, admittedly. But like, come on, man. To your point, then after all this, there's obvious footage that shows this Bucks staffer in a forest green quarter zip running out to the court to get the ball to then where Rick Carlisle is asked about it. He doesn't even like acknowledge that Giannis's accomplishment is even worthy of a game ball. But then he says that the Bucks players who confronted them in the hallway elbowed his GM, Kevin Pritchard, and he's got a bruised rib now. Like, Rick Carlisle a week ago in Vegas wanted to temper the media when he said, Rick Carlisle said from his mouth that Andrew Nembhard might have hyperextended his knee. And then a reporter said to him, just to be clear, you think he hyperextended his knee? He's like, oh, no, I have no idea. Like, I don't want to be. But now he's going out and saying that Kevin Pritchard has a bruised rib, which
just
like...
Just for the purposes of clarity, I believe he said it was Chad Buchanan, the GM Chad Buchanan.
Oh, Chad Buchanan. I'm sorry.
My apologies.
I'm sorry, Chad. I hope your rib is okay. And then after all that, Eric Name, my guy, asks Giannis to confirm if he has the game ball. And not just Giannis, but then Dame doubles down too. They're swearing they don't know. Giannis says, I have a ball, but I don't know if it's the game ball. It doesn't feel like the game ball to me. It feels like a brand new ball. I played 35 minutes today. I know how the game ball felt. Like, bro, what are we doing? And there's people celebrating this online as if like, this is why the NBA is awesome. This is why the NBA is silly. If you like the silliness, for sure. But the fact that now this has become a debate on who's right and who should have gotten the ball, and it's the Bucks versus the Pacers, and what side are you on? That's the part that's really pissing me off.
Oh, I'm glad you could get that off your chest. I'm glad we could work through those feelings here. I know this is not a self-help podcast about basketball, but I'm glad we can still work through some of those things.
Thank you. Again, I'll be a guest on Divine Intervention anytime you ask.
Yeah, no, yeah, we're definitely going to get around to you. The other thing we didn't bring up, but like it is definitely part of the inciting incident of this is Aaron Nesmith just like, there was a flagrant foul earlier in the game where Giannis is going to the basket and Nesmith just like is trying to wrap him up to keep him from getting the ball on the backboard and winds up pulling him down.
Even there, you know, video zoomed in on Thanasis freaking out on the bench. Hold me back. The dude, and I really love Thanasis. I have enjoyed my time talking with him, watching him in Manila for the Greek team was a delight because he is just as animated there. If he really wanted to get there, he would have gotten there. And he's like, he hooked his arm. If you want to really look at the footage, he hooked his arm around Jay Crowder's arm. He told Jay Crowder, hold me back. Not the other, like, come on, man. This is all an act. It's all a sham. This is WWE.
I was going to say, shades of Goldberg, the goalie in Mighty Ducks saying like, hold me back. Don't go over there. That guy will kill you. I know, but you got to hold me back. So it looks like I'm going to go kill him. So yeah. I just used to believe that Thanasis is really studying the great films of American cinema and really modeling his behavior after Goldberg the goalie.
Look, as someone who has said, I believe on these airwaves, I want the NBA to be as WWE as possible. I don't mean it like that. I mean it as
you make the wish, the monkey paw curls a finger, and here you are. You know, this is you don't always get it the way you want it, my friend. Sometimes you get what's
true.
What's coming to you, perhaps, more than anything else. And so, yeah, I don't know.
It's just my plea to go in the writer's room. Bring me inside. Let me help. I will make it better.
Oh, somebody reached out to me who used to be in WWE creative. Because they're like, you sometimes make jokes about wrestling and I love your basketball coverage. And I was like, bring me in that writer's room. Let me find out what it's like to write, you know, a storyline for, I don't know, R-Truth or something like that. Anyway, the drama and the silliness and the cap on the app and the sprinting down tunnels looking for game balls and gamesmanship. And then also maybe everybody's just wrong. It is something to pay attention to. And it's
embarrassing is what it is.
Yeah. I mean, like, I'm not like, but I can think that, but I'm also the guy who's going to write like 2,000 words about the friggin' Timberwolves defense, right? Like, of course, I'm not that there for that. The casual fans who are the ones who keep the lights on and thank you so much for watching and listening to our podcast are much more likely to be interested in stuff like that. So if we can present both sides of this thing, the interesting part from a bigger picture perspective is there's like actual heat between these two teams now. And they are going to play again another two-game series in a couple of weeks, right? And so, like, we're going to have, like, we've generated some beef in a rivalry here where also you're going to watch these games for some bad feelings and also a ton of points, because God bless the Pacers being an offense good enough that you got to score 60 to beat them, and a defense bad enough that they'll let you score 60 to beat them. So there's a game component that is actually like the game on the court that's fun and that is competitive and that is interesting, and there's a reason that these guys are going to care about it. And then there's also the other stuff too that can bring more people in. So I don't know. Everybody come under the big tent. There's a circus going on, and you know there's something to enjoy no matter what you're looking for.
Yeah. The last thing I'll say is, like, to me, with the WWE of it all, give me that Matt Ishbia, Nikola Jokic playoffs ball thing over this. Like, every day. That's the line. That's where I draw the line. Jokic laughs about it. They have a whole pregame moment the next game where they're like, ha, we're wrestling. But when it's this, like, it came up with the tiebreaker stuff during the World Cup. Not the World Cup, the in-season tournament, excuse me. There's too many layers of these unwritten rules of like what you're supposed to do in the NBA for all these like macho men who make millions of dollars to be so sensitive about. That's just my thought. That's my take. And we are moving along to a team full of players who make a lot of money to the point where people are wondering how long they can sustain this roster. The Minnesota Timberwolves. That's a question for another day. For now, I think everyone is just celebrating what is in the here and now. They are first in the West. They are arguably the best team in the league. They are playing playoff-style basketball in 23-24. Slowest pace. Number one defensive rating. Dan, I'm going to get out of the way. This is a team you spent much of time, many a minute, writing and thinking about last night. What say you?
Yeah, not enough. I should have stayed up all night and finished it, but I fell asleep for a few hours. So you're probably going to read the story that's resulting from this on Friday. So keep your fingers crossed for a good game for the Wolves on Thursday against the Mavs. That doesn't have to be win or lose, just interesting. And then we'll be able to pivot around that for Friday. This is the coming together, the plan being realized a year late. This is exactly what Tim Connelly was trying to do by going and getting Rudy Gobert and giving over everything that he could, with the exception of Jaden McDaniels, which is a very important exception, to get Rudy Gobert in the house. The Wolves, for the final four months of the previous season.
Get in the house, Rudy Gobert.
Get in the house, Rudy Gobert. You get. The final 4 months of the 21-22 season, they were the best offense in the NBA. They were not good on defense. They could not clear the defensive glass, stop Brandon Clark from getting offensive rebounds, keep John Morant out of the paint. They lose in the playoffs because of that. Despite Anthony Edwards having a great first playoff series, despite Karl-Anthony Towns at times looking unguardable, their defense and their rebounding was a big enough problem that they were like, we got to solve this. Enter Rudy Gobert, the solution to a defensive problem. Unfortunately, last season, he is coming out. He's like all dinged up coming off of Eurobasket for France and gets a late start to camp. Karl-Anthony Towns gets sick at the start of camp, misses like almost, I think, all of training camp and preseason, loses like 17 pounds in the hospital, and then picks up a calf strain like 20 games into the season, misses almost the entire season. They never congeal. They never coalesce. There's the first half season with D'Angelo Russell where it's like it just didn't feel like everything was sort of clicking and going right. They get Mike Conley, they reorganize, they reorient, and now what we're seeing is the goal. This was the plan. If we can be a good enough offense, we can be an elite defense, we're going to be a really good team, a 50-plus win team, and give ourselves a chance to make deep playoff runs. Because the idea is like, what if the Utah Jazz, but with multiple perimeter defenders who can actually defend, instead of what if, you know, Utah Jazz with Donovan Mitchell and small Mike Conley backcourt and no 3-and-D wing nearly on the level of Jaden McDaniels.
Conley is still a factor in the equation, though.
He is, but you look at their roster, and they very clearly have indexed on huge. Like, we are going to just be giant. It's Rudy and Karl-Anthony Towns up front. It's Naz Reid off the bench, and Kyle Anderson off the bench. Yeah, Naz Reid, like quiet, low-key, sixth man of the year candidate, especially if they keep up this winning. He's been awesome for them. And fits what they need to do perfectly. And you know, Nikhil Alexander Walker seemed like sort of a throw-in or a scratch-off ticket in the Conley, the big multi-team mega deal that landed Conley and then put D'Angelo Russell in LA and Westbrook in Utah and yada, yada, yada. Nikhil Alexander Walker has been awesome for them. And another like 6'5", 6'10", wingspan, spidery perimeter defender. That's another like problem at the point of attack. Their deep bench guys, Troy Brown, Shake Milton, like they're huge for their positions too. All of these guys are just really big. The only exceptions are Conley and Jordan McLaughlin, really. And that's like, those guys are both point of attack pests and you can maneuver around them. You can cover for them to some degree if you've got huge, really good defenders everywhere else. And Karl-Anthony Towns is not a really good defender, but he's much more comfortable this year. They've actually got some reps under their belt. They understand how to maneuver with one another. Rudy Gobert understands better how to cover for Kat in space, and Kat understands that he's got that help behind him. So he's a little more aggressive in the pick and roll coverage. Like, everybody's clicking and working well. And if you are that good on defense, and they are that good on defense, there's a number that'll be in the piece tomorrow, but I'll step on it now because whatever, we're here.
Yeah, step on it.
They lead the league in defensive efficiency, as you mentioned, and they're allowing 7.4 fewer points per 100 possessions than a league average defense this season. 7.4 fewer than the league average defense. That's the biggest, or the fifth biggest differential between like your defense and the league average defense since 2000. The only teams that have been better than that, had a bigger differential than that, the 03-04 Pistons, the 07-08 Celtics, both of whom won the championship, and then the 03-04 Spurs and the 2019-20 Bucks, which are like 56-57 win teams that won a playoff series. And that's what they want to build this off of. They want to build it off of that defense and then think our offensive ceiling in a series where we have Ant and where we have Cat can get there against anybody. And so it remains to be seen whether that works out. But like, you're seeing the patience of not just panicking and scrapping it last offseason and doubling down on it by bringing back Naz Reid, by handing Jaden McDaniels that huge extension, by keeping this core together. They've doubled down on what they believed in before this season. And the early returns of it have been like not only good, but exactly what they'd hoped it would look like. And in the process, created a legitimate contender in the West.
They're exactly what the San Antonio Spurs hope to become one day. No, I'm just kidding.
No, but not for nothing. When you said you're watching Wembanyama at the five, and it's like this, the amount of ground he can cover and the way that changes the way offenses think about what shots they do and don't want to take. Watch Rudy Gobert on defense for, you know, a quarter, a shift, whatever, and you will see every ball handler pulling the ball down, refusing to take a floater, not wanting to go too far into the paint. Like, a guy that big, that long, that active, and that smart about when to go for it and when not to completely changes the trajectory of an offense and completely changes the flow of every ball handler that comes even near the paint. You mix that up with somebody who can also defend in space. And like, Rudy Gobert has been a really good isolation defender, you know, quiet as it's kept. Like, guys that can do that fundamentally change the geometry of the floor. Wembanyama obviously already has walked into the NBA able to do that, and at a higher level, you know, the hope is at a higher level than Gobert, who also is a three-time defensive player of the year and looks to be well on his way to a fourth. So a higher level than that is going to be awfully tough to get to, but that's, you know, this is what Wembanyama's promise looks like.
And look, Tim Connolly, who put this all together, as you said, he did come to Minnesota after being the general manager who built a contender around Nikola Jokic, who has done nothing but continue to establish that he is the best player, if not one of the three best players in the league, en route to winning a title last year. And it would help to have someone like Rudy Gobert to be able to throw at him, and then have some fouls from Karl-Anthony Towns, and then have some fouls from Naz Reid. And then some fouls from Luka Garza, whoever else is being tasked up next.
Small ball five slow-mo. Let's go. Let's get that trended in the chat. Can I get a hell yeah in the chat for small ball five slow-mo?
I mean, you get a hell yeah from Chris Finch, who, shout out to Finch, he was a podcast guest back in July during Summer League. Seems to, he can't quit Kyle Anderson. Kyle Anderson is always in there in crunch time. We have a problem. Call Kyle Anderson. Slap a Kyle Anderson on that hole and see if it doesn't have a leak anymore. So, I think the other thing too is like, this season was so phrased as like about the Anthony Edwards leap. He's making the leap. It was the whole talk of the World Cup stretch and what have you. The fact that that is not the dominating storyline and not what the Wolves are revolving around, to me, is very important. I think that's like a narrative-y thing more than a real thing, but like it is a real thing in terms of like the hierarchy of this team, because on a, on the ground level, on a behind the scenes, behind the locker room doors level, this has been Karl Anthony Towns' team for basically a decade. They drafted him first in 2015, and even though they did the trade with Kevin Love that brought Andrew Wiggins, the previous number one pick there, this has always been about Cat. Can Cat put this franchise on his shoulders? And there was definitely some type of tangible fear of like uncomfortability about Anthony Edwards kind of wrestling that mantle from Cat's clutches. And it just hasn't been the case. I mean, I remember I didn't write about it yet. I've kind of kept the audio in the files for when a rainy day, when maybe it could be available. But the Wolves played the Knicks during the preseason, and I went to a Saturday morning shoot around at MSG, and I asked Kat about that. Like, how do you both help and encourage his rise while also like not having a tug of war over whose team this is? And he basically just said, like, you just don't, like, you try to support the guy, we're in this together, blah blah blah. And it sounds cliche, but I do think it's real. I still see, that's my one, and I'm gonna be hard on this dude for his entire career until he has like a Devin Booker like maturation, just because I am such a big fan of him. There's still those glimpses of like, I mean, I know all the numbers are not up, I know the turnovers are down, what have you, but there's still those little moments where, and I saw it a lot during the World Cup, where like he'll get super hot and he'll just drive up and take a really bad pull up three, or he'll drive into traffic and I'll try to kick it out and to the guy in the corner, but it'll be 5 feet to his left, and it's, and they don't show up on the highlight reels in between all the step backs and him scoring eight of 12 points down the fourth quarter stretch. But like those little lapses that are always happening with the Spurs that Victor Wembanyama was talking about is like, this is what we got to, like, he's still 21 years old, Anthony Edwards. Like, he's still, this is just his fourth year in the league. Like, there's still so much room for growth that I'm bullish. I think he'll get there. It's just the one thing that I'm going to keep harping on and putting a magnifying glass on, because when none of this matters from the standpoint of Minnesota, unless it is successful in the postseason. You know, they lost in the first round last year. Like, at a certain point, I mean, there's going to be a ton of teams who have real playoff expectations who don't do anything, because there are a ton of teams who have real playoff expectations. Just the stakes we talked about at the beginning of this, with the finances at play, with the new ownership group supposed to be coming in, but if they can't afford it, then Glenn Taylor will still hold the reins. Like, that stuff is very real behind the scenes. And if there isn't tangible postseason, we made a run at this thing, I don't know pragmatically how long this unit can stay together. So that is the ultimate like barometer of all this. And no matter what, no matter the Rudy, no matter the Cat, no matter the Naz Reid, no matter the Shake Milton and Kyle Anderson, whatever, I personally am most invested in seeing the continuing ironing out of those wrinkles of Anthony Edwards' game. That's what I want to see happen over these next 60 games or so. So to me, that's like the cherry on top of a Sunday that's already pretty good.
Yeah, two things on that before we get out of here. One is just like, you're absolutely right. There's definitely more growth for Ant. Like, he has been taking a ton of mid-range pull-ups, and that's become a comfortable shot for him. It's something he's hitting at a really high level.
It's his favorite shot.
But it's that question of like, are you settling somewhat for that as opposed to getting all the way to the rim, considering how good a finisher you are? And like, what is that? What else would that open up if you were a little bit more active, aggressive, and driving all the way to the basket?
Get fouled too, baby.
Yeah, and his free throws are up, but like, could you even get to another level with that? And so you're absolutely right. It's also worth noting though, like before he picked up this hip injury and had like the 3-minute game where he wound up leaving early and has been out, in and out of the lineup, he was up over 25 points, 5 rebounds, 5 assists a game on like above league average true shooting. And that is like the MVP conversation. The only guys
the LeBron, right?
Yeah, it's like the only guys doing that are, it's like you're all NBA first and second team. And so he's there at whatever, 21, 22, while still figuring all this stuff out. Well, Mike Conley's like, we'll make a point guard out of him yet. For it to still be that developmental is, and for it to be this good while there's still so much development to go is kind of incredible. And but as you said, you're absolutely right to frame the franchise's development and the franchise's arc in terms of what it means in the playoffs. It's also worth remembering, though, what the franchise is and has been. The Wolves have been a franchise for 35 years. They've advanced out of the first round once. They've had like one actual really good team, and it was that 158. 58 and 24 Garnett team with Sam Cassell and Latrell Sprewell in 2003-2004. This has a chance to be that good. The best team in the franchise's history or the second best team in the franchise's history. And so the franchise needs to think about what is sustainable for the long term and the finances that, Mark Lohr and Alex Rodriguez and whoever else are going to be willing to pay.
Yeah,
and
those guys weren't around for 35 years. They haven't been mired in, postseason droughts and what have you.
Right. But there's a lot of people up in the Twin Cities who have. And so for them to get of this team.
Those people's opinions don't matter when it comes to whether they're going to foot the bill of this whole, roster.
Right, but Jake, they matter to us. We're not talking to the executive class. We're talking to the fucking fans. And so,
to tell the fans an accurate portrayal of like why the playoffs matter so much for this franchise at this stage of their history, that's the truth.
It is true, but I'm saying more than one thing can matter. And yes, you're right that like the long range projections for this team and a financial future of the team. A lot of the decisions will wind up coming down to what happens in the playoffs. Absolutely. But they've needed to be, before you can be great, you need to be good. And they haven't been consistently good for a long time. And they're a kind of good and a level of good this year that the Wolves have almost never been in their franchise's history. And if you are a Wolves fan who has suffered through an awful lot of shitty basketball for the better part of 3.5 decades, I hope you're enjoying this, because this is what it looks like when a team's plan actually works and you get serious top end talent to execute it. And so it's been one of the cooler things to watch in the early going of the season. It is a kind of rare joy that some fan bases are rarely afforded. And so I hope you dig it, because Jake Fisher's here to tell you that it's not going to last very long if things don't go well in the playoffs.
Yeah. Sorry to be a doomsayer, but I hope they are enjoying it. And I hope everyone is enjoying this podcast, because that's all we've got for you today. Thanks to John Gennaro for doing all the things he does to make the show look and sound great. Follow us on various social media platforms that are out there at Jake L. Fisher, at Your Man Divine. Subscribe to Ball Don't Lie on YouTube and whatever podcast platform you're currently listening on. And please leave us a 5-star review. That would be great. We thank you for listening, and we'd appreciate it if you came back again next week for another episode of No Cap Room.